Side 2.
Chapter 6. From here, it was a 4-mile walk to his village. A mile further to the turning, to which the abominable Russell had now fiercely declined to take him, and from there, a further 3 miles of winding country lane. The Saab seethed off into the night. Arthur watched it go, as stunned as a man might be who, having believed himself to be totally blind for 5 years, suddenly discovers that he had merely been wearing too large a hat. He shook his head sharply in the hope that it might dislodge some salient fact which would fall into place and make some sense of an otherwise utterly bewildering universe. But since the salient fact, if there was one, entirely failed to do this, he set off up the road again, hoping that a good vigorous walk, and maybe even some good painful blisters, would help to reassure him of his own existence at least, if not his sanity. It was 10:30 when he arrived, a fact he discovered from the steamed and greasy window of the Horse and Groom pub, in which there had hung for many years a battered old Guinness clock, which featured a picture of an emu with a pint glass jammed, rather amusingly, down its throat. This was the pub at which he had passed the fateful lunchtime, during which first his house and then the entire planet Earth had been demolished, or rather, had seemed to be demolished. No, damn it, had been demolished, because if it hadn't, then where the bloody heck had he been for the last 8 years, and how had he got there if not in one of those big yellow Vogon ships which the appalling Russell had just been telling him were merely drug-induced hallucinations? And yet if it had been demolished, what was he currently standing on? He jammed the brake on this line of thought because it wasn't going to get him any further than it had the last 20 times he'd been over it. He started again. This was the pub at which he had passed the fateful lunchtime during which whatever it was had happened, that he was going to have to sort out later, had happened. And it still didn't make sense. He started again. This was the pub in which... This was a pub. Pubs served drinks, and he couldn't half do with one. Satisfied that his jumbled thought processes had at last arrived at a conclusion, and a conclusion he was happy with, even if it wasn't the one he'd set out to achieve, he strode towards the door and stopped. A small black wire-haired terrier ran out from behind a low wall and then, catching sight of Arthur, began to snarl. Now, Arthur knew this dog, and he knew it well. It belonged to an advertising friend of his and was called Know-Nothing Bozo, because the way its hair stood up on its head reminded people of the President of the United States of America. And the dog knew Arthur, or at least should do. It was a stupid dog, could not even read an auto cue, which is why some people had protested about its name. But it should at least have been able to recognise Arthur instead of standing there, hackles raised, as if Arthur was the most fearful apparition ever to intrude upon its feeble-witted life. This prompted Arthur to go and peer at the window again, this time with an eye not for the asphyxiating emu, but for himself. Seeing himself for the first time, suddenly in a familiar context, he had to admit that the dog had a point. He looked a lot like something a farmer would use to scare birds with, and there was no doubt but that to go into the pub in his present condition would excite comment of a raucous kind. And worse still, there would doubtless be several people in there at the moment whom he knew, all of whom would be bound to bombard him with questions which, at the moment, he felt ill-equipped to deal with. Will Smithers, for instance, the owner of Know-Nothing Bozo, the non-wonder dog, an animal so stupid that it had been sacked from one of Will's own commercials for being incapable of knowing which dog food it was supposed to prefer, despite the fact that the meat in all the other bowls had had engine oil poured over it. Will would definitely be in there. Here was his dog, there was his car, a grey Porsche 928S, with a sign in the back window which read, "My other car is also a Porsche." Damn him. He stared at it and realised that he had just learnt something he hadn't known before. Will Smithers, like most of the overpaid and underscrupulous bastards Arthur knew in advertising, made a point of changing his car every August, so that he could tell people his accountant made him do it, though the truth was that his accountant was trying like hell to stop him, what with all the alimony he had to pay and so on. And this was the same car Arthur remembered him having before. The number plate proclaimed its year. Given that it was now winter, and that the event which had caused Arthur so much trouble 8 of his personal years ago had occurred at the beginning of September, less than 6 or 7 months could have passed here. He stood terribly still for a moment and let Know-Nothing Bozo jump up and down yapping at him. He was suddenly stunned by a realisation he could no longer avoid, which was this. He was now an alien on his own world. Try as they might, no one was even going to be able to believe his story. Not only did it sound perfectly potty, but it was flatly contradicted by the simplest observable facts. Was this really the Earth? Was there the slightest possibility that he'd made some extraordinary mistake? The pub in front of him was unbearably familiar to him in every detail, every brick, every piece of peeling paint, and inside he could sense its familiar, stuffy, noisy warmth, its exposed beams, its unauthentic cast-iron light fittings, its bar sticky with beer that people he knew had put their elbows in, overlooked by cardboard cutouts of girls with packets of peanuts stapled all over their breasts. It was all the stuff of his home, his world. He even knew this blasted dog. "Hey, know nothing!" The sound of Will Smithers' voice meant he had to decide what to do quickly. If he stood his ground, he would be discovered and the whole circus would begin. To hide would only postpone the moment, and it was bitterly cold now. The fact that it was Will made the choice easier. It wasn't that Arthur disliked him as such. Will was quite fun. It was just that he was fun in such an exhausting way, because being in advertising, he always wanted you to know how much fun he was having and where he'd got his jacket from. Mindful of this, Arthur hid behind a van. "Hey, Know-Nothing, what's up?" The door opened and Will came out, wearing a leather flying jacket that he'd got a mate of his at the Road Research Laboratory to crash a car into, especially, in order to get that battered look. Know-Nothing yelped with delight, and having got the attention it wanted, was happy to forget Arthur. Will was with some friends, and they had a game they played with the dog. "Commies!" they all shouted at the dog in chorus. "Commies! Commies! Commies!" The dog went berserk with barking, prancing up and down, yapping its little heart out beside itself in transports of ecstatic rage. They all laughed and cheered it on, then gradually dispersed to their various cars and disappeared into the night. "Well, that clears one thing up," thought Arthur from behind the van. "This is quite definitely the planet I remember." Chapter 7. His house was still there. How or why, he had no idea. He had decided to go and have a look while he was waiting for the pub to empty, so that he could go and ask the landlord for a bed for the night when everyone else had gone. And there it was. He hurriedly let himself in with a key he kept under a stone frog in the garden, because, astoundingly, the phone was ringing. He had heard it faintly all the way up the lane and started to run as soon as he realized where the sound was coming from. The door had to be forced open because of the astonishing accumulation of junk mail on the doormat. It jammed itself stuck on what he would later discover were 14 identical, personally addressed invitations to apply for a credit card he already had, 17 identical threatening letters for non-payment of bills on a credit card he didn't have, 33 identical letters saying that he personally had been specially selected as a man of taste and discrimination who knew what he wanted and where he was going in today's sophisticated jet-setting world, and would he therefore like to buy some grotty wallet, and also a dead tabby kitten. He rammed himself through the relatively narrow opening afforded by all this, stumbled through a pile of wine offers that no discriminating connoisseur would want to miss, slithered over a heap of beach villa holidays, blundered up the dark stairs to his bedroom, and got to the phone just as it stopped ringing. He collapsed panting onto his cold, musty-smelling bed, and for a few minutes stopped trying to prevent the world from spinning round his head in the way it obviously wanted to. When it had enjoyed its little spin and had calmed down a bit, Arthur reached out for his bedside light, not expecting it to come on. To his surprise, it did. This appealed to Arthur's sense of logic. Since the electricity board cut him off without fail every time he paid his bill, it seemed only reasonable that they should leave him connected when he didn't. Sending them money obviously only drew attention to yourself. The room was much as he had left it, i.e. festeringly untidy, though the effect was muted a little by a thick layer of dust. Half-read books and magazines nestled amongst piles of half-used towels. Half-pairs of socks reclined in half-drunk cups of coffee. What was once a half-eaten sandwich had now half-turned into something that Arthur entirely didn't want to know about. Bang a fork of lightning through this lot, he thought to himself, and you'd start the evolution of life off all over again. There was only one thing in the room that was different. For a moment or so he couldn't see what the one thing was that was different, because it too was covered in a film of disgusting dust. Then his eyes caught it and stopped. It was next to a battered old television, on which it was only possible to watch Open University study courses, because if it tried to show anything more exciting, it would break down. It was a box. Arthur pushed himself up on his elbows and peered at it. It was a grey box with a kind of dull lustre to it. It was a cubic grey box, just over a foot on a side. It was tied with a single grey ribbon, knotted into a neat bow on the top. He got up, walked over, and touched it in surprise. Whatever it was clearly gift-wrapped, neatly and beautifully, and was waiting for him to open it. Cautiously, he picked it up and carried it back to the bed. He brushed the dust off the top and loosened the ribbon. The top of the box was a lid, with a flap tucked into the body of the box. He untucked it and looked into the box. In it was a glass globe, nestling in fine grey tissue paper. He drew it out carefully. It wasn't a proper globe because it was open at the bottom, or, as Arthur realized turning it over, at the top, with a thick rim. It was a bowl, a fish bowl. It was made of the most wonderful glass, perfectly transparent, yet with an extraordinary silver-grey quality, as if crystal and slate had gone into its making. Arthur slowly turned it over and over in his hands. It was one of the most beautiful objects he had ever seen, but he was entirely perplexed by it. He looked into the box, but other than the tissue paper, there was nothing. On the outside of the box, there was nothing. He turned the bowl round again. It was wonderful. It was exquisite. But it was a fish bowl. He tapped it with his thumbnail, and it rang with a deep and glorious chime, which was sustained for longer than seemed possible. And when at last it faded, seemed not to die away, but to drift off into other worlds, as into a deep sea dream. Entranced, Arthur turned it round yet again, and this time the light from the dusty little bedside lamp caught it at a different angle, and glittered on some fine abrasions on the fishbowl's surface. He held it up, adjusting the angle to the light, and suddenly saw clearly the finely engraved shapes of words shadowed on the glass. "So long," they said, "and thanks." And that was all. He blinked and understood nothing. For fully 5 more minutes he turned the object round and around, held it to the light at different angles, tapped it for its mesmerizing chime, and pondered on the meaning of the shadowy letters, but could find none. Finally he stood up, filled the bowl with water from the tap, and put it back on the table next to the television. He shook the little babelfish from his ear and dropped it, wriggling, into the bowl. He wouldn't be needing it any more, except for watching foreign movies. He returned to lie on his bed and turned out the light. He lay still and quiet. He absorbed the enveloping darkness, slowly relaxed his limbs from end to end, eased and regulated his breathing, gradually cleared his mind of all thought, closed his eyes, and was completely incapable of getting to sleep. The night was uneasy with rain. The rain clouds themselves had now moved on, and were currently concentrating their attention on a small transport cafe just outside Bournemouth. But the sky through which they had passed had been disturbed by them, and now wore a damply ruffled air, as if it didn't know what else it might not do if further provoked. The moon was out in a watery way. It looked like a ball of paper from the back pocket of jeans that have just come out from the washing machine, and which only time and ironing would tell if it was an old shopping list or a £5 note. The wind flicked about a little, like the tail of a horse that's trying to decide what sort of mood it's in tonight, and a bell somewhere chimed midnight. A skylight creaked open. It was stiff and had to be jiggled and persuaded a little, because the frame was slightly rotten and the hinge had at some time in its life been rather sensibly painted over. But eventually it was open. A strut was found to prop it, and a figure struggled out into the narrow gully between the opposing pitches of the roof. It stood and watched the sky in silence. The figure was completely unrecognizable as the wild-looking creature who had burst crazily into the cottage a little over an hour ago. Gone was the ragged, threadbare dressing gown, smeared with the mud of 100 worlds, stained with junk food condiment from 100 grimy spaceports, Gone was the tangled mane of hair, gone the long and knotted beard, flourishing ecosystem and all. Instead, there was Arthur Dent, the smooth and casual, in corduroys and a chunky sweater. His hair was cropped and washed, his chin clean-shaven. Only the eyes still said that whatever it was the universe thought it was doing to him, he would still like it pleased to stop. They were not the same eyes with which he had last looked out at this particular scene, and the brain which interpreted the images the eyes resolved was not the same brain. There had been no surgery involved, just the continual wrenching of experience. The night seemed like an alive thing to him at this moment, the dark earth around him a being in which he was rooted. He could feel like a tingle on distant nerve ends, the flood of a far river, the roll of invisible hills, the knot of heavy rain clouds parked somewhere away to the south. He could sense, too, the thrill of being a tree, which was something he hadn't expected. He knew that it felt good to curl your toes in the earth, but he'd never realized it could feel quite as good as that. He could sense an almost unseemly wave of pleasure reaching out to him all the way from the New Forest. He must try the summer, he thought, and see what having leaves felt like. From another direction, he felt the sensation of being a sheep startled by a flying saucer, but it was virtually indistinguishable from the feeling of being a sheep startled by anything else it ever encountered, for they were creatures who learnt very little on their journey through life, and would be startled to see the sun rising in the morning, and astonished by all the green stuff in the field. He was surprised to find that he could feel the sheep being startled by the sun that morning, and the morning before, and being startled by a clump of trees the day before that. He could go further and further back, but it got dull because all it consisted of was sheep being startled by things they'd been startled by the day before. He left the sheep and let his mind drift outwards sleepily in developing ripples. It felt the presence of other minds, hundreds of them, thousands in a web, some sleepy, some sleeping, some terribly excited, one fractured. One fractured. He passed it fleetingly and tried to feel for it again, but it eluded him like the other card with an apple on it in Pelmanism. He felt a spasm of excitement because he knew instinctively who it was, or at least knew who it was he wanted it to be, and once you know what it is you want to be true, instinct is a very useful device for enabling you to know that it is. He instinctively knew that it was Fenny, and that he wanted to find her. But he could not. By straining too much for it, he could feel he was losing the strange new faculty, so he relaxed the search and let his mind wander more easily once more. And again, he felt the fracture. Again, he couldn't find it. This time, whatever his instinct was busy telling him it was all right to believe, he wasn't certain that it was Fenny, or perhaps it was a different fracture this time. It had the same disjointed quality, but it seemed a more general feeling of fracture, deeper, not a single mind, maybe not a mind at all. It was different. He let his mind sink slowly and widely into the earth, rippling, seeping, sinking. He was following the earth through its days, drifting with the rhythms of its myriad pulses, seeping through the webs of its life, swelling with its tides, turning with its weight. Always the fracture kept returning, a dull, disjointed, distant ache. And now he was flying through a land of light. The light was time. The tides of it were days receding. The fracture he had sensed, the second fracture, lay in the distance before him, across the land, the thickness of a single hair, across the dreaming landscape of the days of earth. And suddenly he was upon it. He danced dizzily over the edge as the dreamland dropped sheer away beneath him, a stupefying precipice into nothing, him wildly twisting, clawing at nothing, flailing in horrifying space, spinning, falling. Across the jagged chasm had been another land, another time, an older world, not fractured from, but hardly joined. Two Earths. He woke. A cold breeze brushed the feverish sweat standing on his forehead. The nightmare was spent, and so, he felt, was he. His shoulders dropped. He gently rubbed his eyes with the tips of his fingers. At last he was sleepy as well as very tired. As to what it meant, if it meant anything at all, he would think about it in the morning, for now he would go to bed and sleep, his own bed, his own sleep. He could see his house in the distance and wondered why this was. It was silhouetted against the moonlight, and he recognised its rather dull, blockish shape. He looked about him and noticed that he was about 18 inches above the rose bushes of one of his neighbours, John Ainsworth. His rose bushes were carefully tended, pruned back for the winter, strapped to canes and labelled, and Arthur wondered what he was doing above them. He wondered what was holding him there, and when he discovered that nothing was holding him there, he crashed awkwardly to the ground. He picked himself up, brushed himself down, and hobbled back to his house on a sprained ankle. He undressed and toppled into bed. While he was asleep, the phone rang again. It rang for fully 15 minutes and caused him to turn over twice. It never, however, stood a chance of waking him up. Chapter 8. Arthur awoke feeling wonderful, absolutely fabulous, refreshed, overjoyed to be home, bouncing with energy, hardly disappointed at all to discover it was the middle of February. He almost danced to the fridge, found the three least hairy things in it, put them on a plate and watched them intently for 2 minutes. Since they made no attempt to move within that time, he called them breakfast and ate them. Between them, they killed a virulent space disease he'd picked up without knowing it in the Phlegethon gas swamps a few days earlier, which otherwise would have killed off half the population of the Western Hemisphere, blinded the other half, and driven everyone else psychotic and sterile. So the Earth was lucky there. He felt strong, he felt healthy. He vigorously cleared away the junk mail with a spade and then buried the cat. Just as he was finishing that, the phone went, but he let it ring while he maintained a moment's respectful silence. Whoever it was would ring back if it was important. He kicked the mud off his shoes and went back inside. There had been a small number of significant letters in the piles of junk. Some documents from the council, dated 3 years earlier, relating to the proposed demolition of his house, and some other letters about the setting up of a public inquiry into the whole bypass scheme in the area. There was also an old letter from Greenpeace, the ecological pressure group to which he occasionally made contributions, asking for help with their scheme to release dolphins and orcas from captivity, and some postcards from friends vaguely complaining that he never got in touch these days. He collected these things together and put them in a cardboard file, which he marked things to do. Since he was feeling so vigorous and dynamic that morning, he even added the word urgent. He unpacked his towel and a few other odd bits and pieces from the plastic bag he had acquired at the Port Braster mega market. The slogan on the side was a clever and elaborate pun in lingua Centauri, which was completely incomprehensible in any other language, and therefore entirely pointless for a duty-free shop at a spaceport. The bag also had a hole in it, so he threw it away. He realized with a sudden twinge that something else must have dropped out in the small spacecraft that had brought him to Earth, kindly going out of its way to drop him right beside the A303. He had lost his battered and space-worn copy of the thing which had helped him find his way across the unbelievable wastes of space he had traversed. He had lost the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, he told himself, this time I really won't be needing it again. He had some calls to make. He had decided how to deal with the massive contradictions his return journey precipitated, which was that he would simply brazen it out. He phoned the BBC and asked to be put through to his department head. "Oh, hello, Arthur Dent here. Look, sorry I haven't been in for 6 months, but I've gone mad." "Oh, not to worry," said his department head. "Thought it was probably something like that. Happens here all the time. How soon can we expect you?" "When do hedgehogs stop hibernating?" "Sometime in the spring, I think." "Well, I'll be in shortly after that." "Righty-ho." He flipped through the yellow pages and made a short list of numbers to try. "Oh, hello. Is that the Old Elms Hospital?" "Yes, I was just phoning to see if I could have a word with Fenella. Fenella... good Lord, silly me. I forget my own name next. Fenella... isn't this ridiculous? A patient of yours, dark-haired girl, came in last night." "I'm afraid we don't have any patients called Fenella." "Oh, don't you? I meant Fiona, of course. We just call her Fen. I'm sorry. Goodbye." Click. Six conversations along these lines began to take their toll on his mood of vigorous, dynamic optimism, and he decided that before it deserted him entirely, he would take it down to the pub and parade it a little. He had had the perfect idea for explaining away every inexplicable weirdness about himself at a stroke, and he whistled to himself as he pushed open the door which had so daunted him last night. "Arthur!" He grinned cheerfully at the boggling eyes that stared at him from all corners of the pub and told them all what a wonderful time he'd had in Southern California. Chapter 9. He accepted another pint and took a pull at it. "Of course, I had my own personal alchemist, too." "You what?" He was getting silly, and he knew it. Exuberance and Hall and Woodhouse Bess Bitter was a mixture to be wary of, but one of the first effects it has is to stop you being wary of things, and the point at which Arthur should have stopped and explained no more was the point at which he started instead to get inventive. "Oh, yes," he insisted with a happy glazed smile, "it's why I've lost so much weight." "What?" said his audience. "Oh, yes," he said again, "the Californians have rediscovered alchemy. Oh, yes." He smiled again. "Only," he said, "it's a much more useful form than that which in..." He paused thoughtfully to let a little grammar assemble itself in its head. "In which the ancients used to practice it. Or at least," he added, "failed to practice it. They couldn't get it to work, you know. Nostradamus and that lot couldn't cut it." "Nostradamus?" said one of his audience. "I didn't think he was an alchemist," said another. "I thought," said a third, "he was a seer." "He became a seer," said Arthur to his audience, the component parts of which were beginning to bob and blur a little, "because he was such a lousy alchemist. You should know that." He took another pull at his beer. It was something he had not tasted for 8 years. He tasted it and tasted it. "What has alchemy got to do," asked a bit of the audience, "with losing weight?" "I'm glad you asked that," said Arthur, "very glad. And I will now tell you what the connection is between..." He paused. "Between those two things, the things you mentioned, I'll tell you." He paused and manoeuvred his thoughts. It was like watching oil tankers doing three-point turns in the English Channel. "They've discovered how to turn excess body fat into gold," he said in a sudden blurt of coherence. "You're kidding." "Oh, yes," he said. "No," he corrected himself. "They have." He rounded on the doubting part of his audience, which was all of it, so it took a little while to round on it completely. "Have you been to California?" he demanded. "Do you know the sort of stuff they do there?" Three members of his audience said they had, and that he was talking nonsense. "You haven't seen anything," insisted Arthur. "Oh, yes," he added, because someone was offering to buy another round. "The evidence," he said, pointing at himself and not missing by more than 2 inches, "is before your eyes. 14 hours in a trance," he said. "In a tank, in a trance. I was in a tank. I think," he added after a thoughtful pause, "I already said that." He waited patiently until the next round was duly distributed. He composed the next bit of the story in his mind, which was going to be something about the tank needing to be oriented along a line dropped perpendicularly from the pole star to a baseline drawn between Mars and Venus, and was about to start trying to say it when he decided to give it a miss. "Long time," he said, and said, "in a tank, in a trance." He looked round severely at his audience to make sure it was all following attentively. He resumed. "Where was I?" he said. "In a trance," said one. "In a tank," said another. "Oh, yes," said Arthur. "Thank you." "And slowly," he said, pressing onwards, "slowly, slowly, slowly, all your excess body fat turns to..." He paused for effect. He paused for breath. "Subcutaneous gold, which you can have surgically removed." "Getting out of the tank is hell. What did you say?" I was just clearing my throat." "I think you doubt me. I was clearing my throat." "She was clearing her throat," confirmed a significant part of the audience in a low rumble. "Oh, yes," said Arthur. "All right. And you then split the proceeds..." He paused again for a maths break. 50-50 with the alchemist. Make a lot of money." He looked swayingly around at his audience and could not help but be aware of an air of scepticism about their jumbled faces. He felt very affronted by this. "How else," he demanded, "could I afford to have my face dropped?" Friendly arms began to help him home. "Listen," he protested as the cold February breeze brushed his face. "Looking lived in is all the rage in California at the moment. You've got to look as if you've seen the galaxy. A life, I mean. You've got to look as if you've seen life. That's what I got, a face drop. Give me 8 years," I said. "I hope being 30 doesn't come back into fashion or I've wasted a lot of money." He lapsed into silence for a while as the friendly arms continued to help him along the lane to his house. "Got in yesterday," he mumbled. "I'm very, very, very happy to be home, or somewhere very like it." "Jet lag," muttered one of his friends. "Long trip from California. Really mucks you up for a couple of days." "I don't think he's been there at all," muttered another. "I wonder where he has been, and what's happened to him." After a little sleep, Arthur got up and pottered around the house a bit. He felt woozy and a little low, still disoriented by the journey. He wondered how he was going to find Fenny. He sat and looked at the fishbowl. He tapped it again, and despite being full of water and a small yellow babelfish, which was gulping its way round rather dejectedly, it still chimed its deep and resonant chime as clearly and mesmerically as before. "Someone is trying to thank me," he thought to himself. He wondered who and for what. Chapter 10. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:20. Beep, beep, beep. Ford Prefect suppressed a little giggle of evil satisfaction, realized that he had no reason to suppress it, and laughed out loud, a wicked laugh. He switched the incoming signal through from the sub-Ethernet to the ship's superb hi-fi system, and the odd, rather stilted sing-song voice spoke out with remarkable clarity round the cabin. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:30. Beep, beep, beep. He tweaked the volume up just a little, while keeping a careful eye on a rapidly changing table of figures on the ship's computer display. For the length of time he had in mind, the question of power consumption became significant. He didn't want a murder on his conscience. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:40. Beep, beep, beep. He checked around the small ship. He walked down the short corridor. At the third stroke, he stuck his head into a small, functional, gleaming steel bathroom. It will be... It sounded fine in there. He looked into the tiny sleeping quarters. 1:32. It sounded a bit muffled. There was a towel hanging over one of the speakers. He took down the towel. And 50 seconds. Fine. He checked out the packed cargo hold and wasn't at all satisfied with the sound. There was altogether too much crated junk in the way. He stepped back out and waited for the door to seal. He broke open a closed control panel and pushed the jettison button. He didn't know why he hadn't thought of that before. A whooshing, rumbling noise died away quickly into silence. After a pause, a slight hiss could be heard again. It stopped. He waited for the green light to show and then opened the door again on the now empty cargo hold. 1:33:50. Very nice. Beep, beep, beep. He then went and had a last thorough examination of the emergency suspended animation chamber, which was where he particularly wanted it to be heard. At the third stroke, it will be 1:34, precisely. He shivered as he peered down through the heavily frosted covering at the dim bulk of the form within. One day, who knew when, it would wake, and when it did, it would know what time it was. Not exactly local time, true, but what the heck. He double-checked the computer display above the freezer bed, dimmed the lights, and checked it again. At the third stroke, it will be... He tiptoed out and returned to the control cabin. 1:34:20. The voice sounded as clear as if he was hearing it over a phone in London, which he wasn't. Not by a long way. He gazed out into the inky night. The star, the size of a brilliant biscuit crumb he could see in the distance, was Zondostina, or, as it was known in the world from which the rather stilted sing-song voice was being received, Pleiades Zeta. The bright orange curve that filled over half the visible area was the giant gas planet Sesiphrus Magna, where the Zaxisian battleships docked, and rising over its horizon was a small, cool blue moon, Epon. At the third stroke, it will be... For 20 minutes he sat and watched as the gap between the ship and Epon closed, as the ship's computer teased and needed the numbers that would bring it into a loop around the little moon, close the loop, and keep it there, orbiting in perpetual obscurity. 1:59. His original plan had been to close down all external signalling and radiation from the ship, to render it as nearly invisible as possible, unless you were actually looking at it. But then he'd had an idea he preferred. It would now emit one single continuous beam, pencil-thin, broadcasting the incoming time signal to the planet of the signal's origin, which it would not reach for 400 years, travelling at light speed, but where it would probably cause something of a stir when it did. Beep, 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 he sniggered. He didn't like to think of himself as the sort of person who giggled or sniggered, but he had to admit that he had been giggling and sniggering almost continuously for well over half an hour now. At the third stroke, the ship was now locked almost perfectly into its perpetual orbit round a little-known and never-visited moon. Almost perfect. One thing only remained. He ran again the computer simulation of the launching of the ship's little escapo buggy, balancing actions, reactions, tangential forces, all the mathematical poetry of motion, and saw that it was good. Before he left, he turned out the lights. As his tiny little cigar tube of an escape craft zipped out on the beginning of its 3-day journey to the orbiting space station Port Sessaphron, it rode for a few seconds a long, pencil-thin beam of radiation that was starting out on a longer journey still. At the third stroke, it will be 2:13:50. He giggled and sniggered. He would have laughed out loud, but he didn't have room. Beep, beep, beep. Chapter 11. April showers I hate especially. However non-committally Arthur grunted, the man seemed determined to talk to him. He wondered if he should get up and move to another table, but there didn't seem to be one free in the whole cafeteria. He stirred his coffee fiercely. Bloody April showers, hate, hate, hate. Arthur stared, frowning, out of the window. A light, sunny spray of rain hung over the motorway. 2 months he'd been back now. Slipping back into his old life had in fact been laughably easy. People had such extraordinarily short memories, including him. 8 years of crazed wanderings around the galaxy now seemed to him not so much like a bad dream as like a film he had videotaped from the TV and now kept in the back of a cupboard without bothering to watch. One effect that still lingered, though, was his joy at being back. Now that the Earth's atmosphere had closed over its head for good, he thought, wrongly, everything within it gave him extraordinary pleasure. Looking at the silvery sparkle of the raindrops, he felt he had to protest. "Well, I like them," he said suddenly, "and for all the obvious reasons, they're light and refreshing, they sparkle and make you feel good." The man snorted derisively. "That's what they all say," he said, and glowered darkly from his corner seat. He was a lorry driver. Arthur knew this because his opening, unprovoked remark had been, "I'm a lorry driver, I hate driving in the rain. Ironic, isn't it? Bloody ironic." If there was a sequitur hidden in this remark, Arthur had not been able to divine it, and had merely given a little grunt, affable but not encouraging. But the man had not been deterred then, and was not deterred now. "They all say that about bloody April showers," he said. "So bloody nice, so bloody refreshing, such charming bloody weather." He leaned forward, screwing his face up as if he was going to say something extraordinary about the government. "What I want to know is this," he said. "If it's going to be nice weather, why," he almost spat, "can't it be nice without bloody raining?" Arthur gave up. He decided to leave his coffee, which was too hot to drink quickly and too nasty to drink cold. "Well, there you go," he said, and instead got up himself. "Bye." He stopped off at the service station shop, then walked back through the car park, making a point of enjoying the fine play of rain on his face. There was even, he noticed, a faint rainbow glistening over the Devon Hills. He enjoyed that too. He climbed into his battered but adored old black Golf GTI, squealed the tyres, and headed out past the islands of petrol pumps and onto the slip road back towards the motorway. He was wrong in thinking that the atmosphere of the Earth had closed finally and forever above his head. He was wrong to think that it would ever be possible to put behind him the tangled web of irresolutions into which his galactic travels had dragged him. He was wrong to think he could now forget that the big, hard, oily, dirty, rainbow-hung Earth on which he lived was a microscopic dot on a microscopic dot, lost in the unimaginable infinity of the universe. He drove on, humming, being wrong about all these things. The reason he was wrong was standing by the slip road under a small umbrella. His jaw sagged. He sprained his ankle against the brake pedal and skidded so hard he very nearly turned the car over. "Fenny!" he shouted. Having narrowly avoided hitting her with the actual car, he hit her instead with the car door as he leant across and flung it open at her. It caught her hand and knocked away her umbrella, which then bowled wildly away across the road. "Shit!" yelled Arthur as helpful as he could, leapt out of his own door, narrowly avoided being run down by McKenna's all-weather haulage, and watched in horror as it ran down Fenny's umbrella instead. The lorry swept along the motorway and away. The umbrella lay like a recently swatted daddy longlegs, expiring sadly on the ground. Tiny gusts of wind made it twitch a little. He picked it up. He said, there didn't seem to be a lot of point in offering the thing back to her. How did you know my name? She said. Oh, well, he said, look, I'll get you another one. He looked at her and tailed off. She was tallish, with dark hair which fell in waves around a pale and serious face. Standing still, alone, she seemed almost somber, like a statue to some important but unpopular virtue in a formal garden. She seemed to be looking at something other than what she looked as if she was looking at. But when she smiled, as she did now, it was as if she suddenly arrived from somewhere. Warmth and life flooded into her face, an impossibly graceful movement into her body. The effect was very disconcerting, and it disconcerted Arthur like hell. She grinned, tossed her bag into the back, and swiveled herself into the front seat. Don't worry about the umbrella, she said to him as she climbed in. It was my brother's, and he can't have liked it, or he wouldn't have given it to me. She laughed and pulled on her seatbelt. You're not a friend of my brother's, are you? No. Her voice was the only part of her which didn't say good. Her physical presence there in the car, his car, was quite extraordinary to Arthur. He felt, as he let the car pull slowly away, that he could hardly think or breathe, and hoped that neither of these functions were vital to his driving, or they were in trouble. So what he had experienced in the other car, her brother's car, the night he had returned exhausted and bewildered from his nightmare years in the stars, had not been the unbalance of the moment. Or if it had been, he was at least twice as unbalanced now, and quite liable to fall off whatever it is that well-balanced people are supposed to be balancing on. So, he said, hoping to kick the conversation off to an exciting start. He was supposed to pick me up, my brother, but phoned to say he couldn't make it. I asked about buses, but the man started to look at a calendar rather than a timetable, so I decided to hitch. So, said Arthur. So here I am, and what I would like to know is how you know my name. Perhaps we ought to first sort out, said Arthur, looking back over his shoulder as he eased his car into the motorway traffic, where I'm taking you. Very close, he hoped, or a long way. Close would mean she lived near him. A long way would mean he could drive her there. I'd like to go to Taunton, she said. Please, if that's all right. It's not far. You can drop me at... You live in Taunton? He said, hoping that he'd managed to sound merely curious rather than ecstatic. Taunton was wonderfully close to him. He could... No, London, she said. There's a train in just under an hour. It was the worst thing possible. Taunton was only minutes away up the motorway. He wondered what to do, and while he was wondering, with horror, heard himself saying, Oh, I can take you to London, and let me take you to London. Bungling idiot. Why on earth had he said let in that stupid way? He was behaving like a 12-year-old. Are you going to London? She asked. I wasn't, he said, but... Bungling idiot. It's very kind of you, she said, but really, no, I like to go by train. And suddenly she was gone. Or rather, that part of her which brought her to life was gone. She looked rather distantly out of the window and hummed lightly to herself. He couldn't believe it. 30 seconds into the conversation, and already he'd blown it. Grown men, he told himself, in flat contradiction of centuries of accumulated evidence about the way grown men behave, do not behave like this. Taunton, 5 miles, said the signpost. He gripped the steering wheel so tightly the car wobbled. He was going to have to do something dramatic. Fenny, he said. She glanced round sharply at him. You haven't told me how... Listen, said Arthur, I will tell you that the story is rather strange, very strange. She was still looking at him, but said nothing. Listen, you said that. Did I? Oh, there are things I must talk to you about, and things I must tell you, a story I must tell you which would... He was thrashing about. He wanted to say something along the lines of... Thy knotted and combined locks to part, and each particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine, but didn't think he could carry it off, and didn't like the hedgehog reference. Which would take more than 5 miles, he settled for in the end, rather lamely, he was afraid. Well, Just supposing, he said, just supposing. He didn't know what was coming next, so he thought he'd just sit back and listen. That there was some extraordinary way in which you were very important to me, and that, though you didn't know it, I was very important to you. But it all went for nothing because we only had 5 miles, and I was a stupid idiot at not knowing how to say something very important to someone I'd only just met and not crash into Laura's at the same time. What would you say? He paused helplessly and looked at her. I should do. Watch the road, she yelped. Shit! He narrowly avoided careering into the side of 100 Italian washing machines and a German lorry. I think, she said with a momentary sigh of relief, you should buy me a drink before my train goes. Chapter 12. There is, for some reason, something especially grim about pubs near stations. A very particular kind of grubbiness, a special kind of pallor to the pork pies. Worse than the pork pies, though, are the sandwiches. There is a feeling which persists in England that making a sandwich interesting, attractive, or in any way pleasant to eat is something sinful that only foreigners do. Make 'em dry is the instruction buried somewhere in the collective national consciousness. Make 'em rubbery. If you have to keep the buggers fresh, do it by washing 'em once a week. It is by eating sandwiches in pubs on Saturday lunchtimes that the British seek to atone for whatever their national sins have been. They're not altogether clear what those sins are, and don't want to know either. Sins are not the sort of things one wants to know about. But whatever sins there are amply atoned for by the sandwiches they make themselves eat. If there is anything worse than the sandwiches, it is the sausages which sit next to them, joyless tubes full of gristle, floating in a sea of something hot and sad, stuck with a plastic pin in the shape of a chef's hat. A memorial, one feels, for some chef who hated the world and died forgotten and alone among his cats in a back stair in Stepney. The sausages are for the ones who know what their sins are and wish to atone for something specific. There must be somewhere better, said Arthur. No time, said Fanny, glancing at her watch. My train leaves in half an hour. They sat at a small wobbly table. On it were some dirty glasses and some soggy beer mats with jokes printed on them. Arthur got Fanny a tomato juice and himself a pint of yellow water with gas in it, and a couple of sausages. He didn't know why. He bought them for something to do while the gas settled in his glass. The barman dunked Arthur's change in a pool of beer on the bar, for which Arthur thanked him. All right, said Fanny, glancing at her watch. Tell me what it is you have to tell me. She sounded, as well she might, extremely sceptical, and Arthur's heart sank. Hardly, he felt, the most conducive setting to try to explain to her, as she sat there, suddenly cool and defensive, that in a sort of out-of-body dream he had had a telepathic sense that the mental breakdown she had suffered had been connected with the fact that, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, the Earth had been demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass, something which he alone on Earth knew anything about, having virtually witnessed it from a Vogon spaceship, and that furthermore both his body and soul ached for her unbearably, and he needed to go to bed with her as soon as was humanly possible. Fanny, he started. I wonder if you'd like to buy some tickets for our raffle. It's just a little one. He glanced up sharply. To raise money for Angie, who's retiring. What? And needs a kidney machine. He was being leant over by a rather stiffly slim, middle-aged woman with a prim knitted suit, a prim little perm, and a prim little smile that probably got licked by prim little dogs a lot. She was holding out a small book of cloakroom tickets and a collecting tin. Only 10 pence each, she said, so you could probably even buy two, without breaking the bank. She gave a tinkly little laugh and then a curiously long sigh. Saying, without breaking the bank, had obviously given her more pleasure than anything since some GIs had been billeted on her during the war. Yes, all right, said Arthur, hurriedly digging in his pocket and producing a couple of coins. With infuriating slowness and prim theatricality, if there was such a thing, the woman tore off 2 tickets and handed them to Arthur. I do hope you win, she said with a smile that suddenly snapped together like a piece of advanced origami. The prizes are so nice. Yes, thank you, said Arthur, pocketing the tickets rather brusquely and glancing at his watch. He turned towards Fanny. So did the woman with the raffle tickets. And what about you, young lady? She said. It's for Angie's kidney machine. She's retiring, you see. Yes. She hoisted the little smile even further up her face. She would have to stop and let it go soon, or the skin would surely split. Look, here you are, said Arthur, and pushed a 50-pence piece at her in the hope that that would see her off. Oh, we are in the money, aren't we? Said the woman with a long, smiling sigh. Down from London, are we? Arthur wished she wouldn't talk so bloody slowly. No, that's all right, really, he said with a wave of his hand, as she started with awful deliberation to peel off 5 tickets, one by one. Oh, but you must have our tickets, insisted the woman, or you won't be able to claim your prize. They're very nice prizes, you know, very suitable. Arthur snatched the tickets and said thank you as sharply as he could. The woman turned to Fenny once again. And now what about... No! Arthur nearly yelled. These are for her, he explained, brandishing the 5 new tickets. Oh, I see. How nice. She smiled sickeningly at both of them. Well, I do hope... Yes, snapped Arthur, thank you. The woman finally departed to the table next to theirs. Arthur turned desperately to Fenny and was relieved to see that she was rocking with silent laughter. He smiled and sighed. Where were we? He said. You were calling me Fenny, and I was about to ask you not to. What do you mean? She twirled the little wooden cocktail stick in her tomato juice. It's why I asked if you were a friend of my brother's, or half-brother, really. He's the only one who calls me Fenny, and I'm not fond of him for it. So what's Fenchurch? What? Fenchurch. Fenchurch? She looked at him sternly. Yes, she said, and I'm watching you like a lynx to see if you're going to ask the same silly question that everyone asks me till I want to scream. I shall be cross and disappointed if you do. Plus, I shall scream, so watch it. She smiled, shook her hair a little forward over her face, and peered at him from behind it. Oh, he said, that's a little unfair, isn't it? Yes. Fine. All right, she said with a laugh. You can ask me. Might as well get it over with. Better than have you call me Fenny the whole time. Presumably, said Arthur. We've only got 2 tickets left, you see, and since you were so generous when I spoke to you before... What? Snapped Arthur. The woman with the perm and the smile and the now nearly empty book of cloakroom tickets was now waving the 2 last ones under his nose. I thought I'd give the opportunity to you because the prizes are so nice. She wrinkled up her nose a little confidentially. Very tasteful. I know you like them, and it is for Angie's retirement present, you see. We want to give her... A kidney machine, yes, said Arthur. Here. He held out 2 more 10-pence pieces to her and took the tickets. A thought seemed to strike the woman. It struck her very slowly. You could watch it coming in like a long wave on a sandy beach. Oh, dear, she said. I'm not interrupting anything, am I? She peered anxiously at both of them. No, it's fine, said Arthur. Everything that could possibly be fine, he insisted, is fine. Thank you, he added. I say, she said, in a delighted ecstasy of worry, you're not in love, are you? It's very hard to say, said Arthur. We haven't had a chance to talk yet. He glanced at Fenchurch. She was grinning. The woman nodded with knowing confidentiality. I'll let you see the prizes in a minute, she said, and left. Arthur turned, with a sigh, back to the girl that he found it hard to say whether he was in love with. "You are about to ask me," she said, "a question." "Yes," said Arthur. "We can do it together, if you like," said Fenchurch. "Was I found in a handbag," joined in Arthur, "in the left luggage office," they said together, "at Fenchurch Street Station," they finished. "And the answer," said Fenchurch, "is no." "Fine," said Arthur. "I was conceived there." "What? I was in the left luggage office?" hooted Arthur. "No, of course not. Don't be silly. What would my parents be doing in the left luggage office?" she said, rather taken aback by the suggestion. "Well, I don't know," spluttered Arthur. "Or rather, it was in the ticket queue." The ticket queue, or so they claim. They refuse to elaborate. They only say you wouldn't believe how bored it is possible to get in the ticket queue at Fenchurch Street Station. She sipped demurely at her tomato juice and looked at her watch. Arthur continued to gurgle for a moment or two. "I'm going to have to go in a minute or two," said Fenchurch, "and you haven't begun to tell me whatever this terrifically extraordinary thing is that you're so keen to get off your chest." "Why don't you let me drive you to London?" said Arthur. "It's Saturday, I've got nothing particular to do, I'd..." "No," said Fenchurch. "Thank you, it's sweet of you, but no. I need to be by myself for a couple of days." She smiled and shrugged. "But... You can tell me another time. I'll give you my number. Arthur's heart went boom, boom, churn, churn as she scribbled seven figures in pencil on a scrap of paper and handed it to him. Now we can relax, she said with a slow smile, which filled Arthur till he thought he would burst. Fenchurch, he said, enjoying the name as he said it. A box, said a trailing voice, of cherry liqueurs, and also, and I know you like this, a gramophone record of Scottish bagpipe music. Yes, thank you, very nice, insisted Arthur. I just thought I'd let you have a look at them, said the permed woman, as you're down from London. She was holding them out proudly for Arthur to see. He could see that they were indeed a box of cherry brandy liqueurs and a record of bagpipe music. That was what they were. I'll let you have your drink in peace now, she said, patting Arthur lightly on his seething shoulder, but I knew you'd like to see. Arthur re-engaged his eyes with Fenchurch's once again, and suddenly was at a loss for something to say. A moment had come and gone between the two of them, but the whole rhythm of it had been wrecked by that stupid, blasted woman. Don't worry, said Fenchurch, looking at him steadily from over the top of her glass. We will talk again. She took a sip. Perhaps, she added, it wouldn't have gone so well if it wasn't for her. She gave a wry smile and dropped her hair forward over her face again. It was perfectly true. He had to admit it was perfectly true.
End of side 2.